Such a distinguished platform. First of all, we bring with you the love and greetings of the Oakland County Bible students. And it's actually as an agent of the Oakland County Bible students that we speak with you this evening. We bring their love and greetings. They wish to be remembered to you by vote. And we'd just like to say for the record that the 20-odd or so years of fellowship that we had with the friends in Michigan has been a wonderful blessing to us, and we hope that we can carry that and be an influence across the ocean for what we have received for all these years. We also bring the love and greetings of Brother John and Sister Edna Holliday in England, Brother Fred and Sister Ivy Beans, Brother Alex and Sister Joan Chartres, and Sister Paula Salomon, and Brother Redrose Green. They asked especially to remember to you, and we've been enjoying their fellowship. So, friends, we're going to talk about a topic tonight which is perhaps a bit obscure. If we look in the period of the development of the church that is called the primitive church, that's the period from about 33 to 539, and then we look within that, there are four periods of the development and the exaltation of the Antichrist. One of those periods is what we would term Paul's day. That was the first period. The second period was approximately the 4th and 5th century, 300 to 494. We're looking at a period that's in between there, that we call the 2nd century. And the pastor, in quoting a secondary source, Lord's Old Roman World, from the second volume, he says, in the second century, there are no greater names than Polycarp, Ignatius, Justin Martyr, Clement, Melito, and Apollonius, quiet bishops or intrepid martyrs, who addressed their flocks in upper chambers and who held no worldly rank, famous only for their sanctity or simplicity of character, and only mentioned for their sufferings and faith. We read of martyrs, some of whom wrote valuable treatises and apologies, but among them we find no people of rank. It was a disgrace to be a Christian in the eye of fashion or power. The early Christian literature is chiefly apologetic, and the doctrinal character is simple and practical. There were controversies in the church, an intense religious life, great activities, great virtues, but no outward conflicts, no secular history. They had not as yet assailed the government or the great social institutions of the empire. It was a small body of pure and blameless men who did not aspire to control society. But they had attracted the notice of the government and were of sufficient consequence to be persecuted. They were looked upon as fanatics who sought to destroy a reverence for existing institutions. And under the subheading, Organized for Power, in this century the polity of the church was quietly organized. There was an organized fellowship among the members. Bishops had become influential, not in society, but amongst the Christians. Dioceses and parishes were established. There was a distinction between city and rural bishops. Delegates of churches assembled to discuss points of faith or suppress nation's heresies. The diocesan system was developed and ecclesiastical centralization commenced. Deacons began to be reckoned amongst the higher clergy. The weapons of excommunication were forged. Missionary efforts were carried on. The festivals of the church were created. Gnosticism was embraced by many leading minds. Catechetical schools taught the faith systematically. The formulas of baptism and the sacraments became of great importance, and monachism became popular. The church was thus laying the foundation for future polity and power. So while we may not see any great events that occurred in the second century, we see the foundations being laid. And that's what we'd like to elaborate upon, to provide a bit of a context for the remarks of the pastor, and to add a little bit of detail. And those who know Brother David are saying to themselves, yes, in some very tedious detail. But this was the period in which the church early lost the inspired message and unconsciously adopted the error that the teachings of the bishops were the equivalent and authority of those of the apostles. Through this broad channel, grievous errors swept away precious truths. So if we look at what the conditions were at the beginning of the second century, Christianity had, in little bits and pieces, seeped into the highest circles. For example, there was a consul who was second only to the emperor, Manius Acilius Glabrio. You'll probably never have to deal with his name again in your life. But by the year 100, Christianity was represented in Asia Minor, Syria, Macedonia, Greece, and in the city of Rome. In the western portions of the empire, it had spread very little, if at all. Asia Minor was unquestionably the most extensively Christianized territory of the empire. And of course, we know from the book of Revelation, reference to the seven churches, which happened to be in Asia, whether even though the text there doesn't say it. At the time, perhaps a few years earlier, at the time of Linus and Cletus, the eastern churches of Syria, Asia Minor, and Greece were making a larger contribution than Rome's to the development of Christianity. Now, this is important to bring out because we know that sooner or later, Rome emerges as the head of the church. So it was in this century that the beginnings of the working of shifting from the east to the west began to take place. Just as we look at the history of Greek civilization as moving from Athens to Alexandria, we are looking at the movement of Christianity from east back west toward Rome. So what was it like in the empire at the time? Well, during this period, the Roman emperors, you'll recall, the Flavians, and particularly under Titus, that's when Jerusalem fell. Domitian, emperor from 81 to 96, he renewed persecution at the end of his reign. He had a consul called Titus Flavius Clement. He was executed for treason. But what did treason mean in this particular charge? Judaism equals atheism equals Christianity equals treason. So at that point, the government had not made that much of a distinction between Judaism and Christianity for the sake of identifying treason. Then there was a period of what we call the Five Good Emperors, or history calls them the Five Good Emperors, from 96 to 180, and there's very little indiscriminate persecution of the Christians. Under Trajan, from 98 to 116, the Roman Empire reaches its greatest geographical extent. He's the first emperor we know with certainty who proscribed secret societies, including Christian churches. He had no true concept of Christianity, but he agreed with his friends Tacitus and Pliny in regarding it as a bad and immoderate superstition. In fact, he sent out Pliny, who was an author at the time, with some questions, you know, how dangerous really are the Christians? And Pliny came back with the announcement that the Christians were harmless and did not practice any immorality. Trajan also ruled that Christians were not to be sought out, but if they were accused and they refused to worship the pagan gods, they were to be punished. So Bill Clinton can't take credit for the first don't ask, don't tell law. This was the original don't ask, don't tell. Under Hadrian, you'll recall, was the Jewish revolt. In 125, there was Hadrian published what he called a postscript or a prescript to the proconsul of Asia, assuming that Christianity is unauthorized and therefore punishable. But his main concern was to assure that proper judicial procedures were followed and that persons are not punished for Christian belief as a result of mob tumults or false anonymous accusations. What an indictment of the Inquisition to follow. Here, even under the persecution of the Romans against the Christians, they were concerned with what we would call due process. Now, we think of the contrast in the Inquisition when a person simply had to be accused in order to be considered guilty. Moving down to Antoninus Pius, 138 to 161, he had a very nice attitude. He said, if the Christians have offended the gods, let the gods take vengeance for themselves. And so this was a more of a friendly environment for Christians. Under Marcus Aurelius, we would just like to point out that under his government, he ordered Christians to be persecuted. In the only reference to Christianity in his meditations, the emperor praises those who are willing to go into martyrdom, but he said, this attitude is only praiseworthy when it is the outcome of reason and not of obstinacy, as is the case with Christians. So, to Marcus Aurelius, he would be considered obstinate rather than reasonable. And we'd also like to point out that under Marcus Aurelius, there were several martyrdoms in Carthage. And this is the first knowledge of Christianity in North Africa. The North African Church, from the 2nd century to the 5th, understood itself as a church of martyrs. It saw itself as a church marked by opposition to the powers which rule this world, spirit-filled elect whose hope was focused on God's future vindication of people who had been faithful to him in the midst of a society who denied him. Now, what we want to bring out here is that this was the precursor of those great thinkers that led to Augustine. Now, he was, of course, much later. But the seeds were sown, the roots were being grown here for this great influence that came from North Africa in the church. And we think that it is no accident that if you look at the mythological roots of Rome, the mythological roots go back to Carthage. And you'll recall Aeneas and Dido and those stories. But it's no accident that the roots of pagan Rome, the roots of Christian Rome, have this common source in North Africa. We now turn to Commodus, 180 to 192, who during his reign and his immediate successors, there was some immunity from persecution, and many were brought into the church, and what characterized them was a gradual decline in discipline. Dear friends, doesn't this also describe the Laodicean and period of the church? That we, in safety and in peace, enjoy the truth. We have access to it now. We don't even have to crack a book anymore, do we? We just press the button on our laptop computer, and there we have the writings of the truth. We move down to Septimius Severus. He was emperor from 193 to 211, and he bridges the gap then out of the 2nd century into the 3rd. And we just like to point out that he enacted a law forbidding conversions to Judaism or Christianity. And history judges this as not appearing to have been an attempt to exterminate Christianity, but to put a check on proselytizing. Dear friends, we may look at our conditions today and say, we're not being criticized for being Christians. The government doesn't really go against us for being Christians. They just don't want to make us to make a test of ourselves and going out and preaching to others. Here's the beginning, the seeds of that persecution, the beginning and seeds of that control. If we look at Christianity and Judaism during this period, now of course we know in this period there was the revolt, but we'd like to point out one little event, an observation of a historian in the years 84 and 85, where there were some excommunications of Christians from Jewish synagogues. And this is the observation that this historian makes. The infant churches experienced from the synagogues persecution which, when full grown, they were to be in a position to return. And what a change, what a reversal of roles. It's excommunications of Christians from the synagogue to the great persecutions of the Jews by the Christians. We have to look also at the influence of Greek philosophy. And we'd like to mention that perhaps the greatest influence was Plato. Now, Plato wasn't from our period. Plato was from the 5th century B.C. But I think we have to acknowledge that Plato was probably, politically, he was the first communist, we think we'd say. Religiously, he was the first Catholic. And we'd like to point out his position on immortality. Plato taught that the soul of man is immortal, that for good or ill, immortality is an inalienable attribute. Another of the influences at this time was Stoicism. That was one of the Greek philosophies. Tertullian was the first Christian writer in whom Roman law and Stoic philosophy appear as determining elements. His able and voluminous Latin writings laid the foundation for Latin theology. He was the first important Christian writer to use Latin, and he forged it into shape for Cyprian, Lactantius, Jerome, and Augustine. So, the ecclesiastical language shifted from Greek to Latin in the 2nd century. There may not have been a lot of writing of great consequence, but this was where that shift began. And Tertullian's view on baptism was such that baptism having such a magical power to cleanse from previous sins but not from subsequent sins, it should be delayed until as near the hour of death as possible. He then is the author of baptism as the so-called extreme unction. And he also argued for the immortality of the soul. Did he argue for it on the basis of the law and the prophets and scripture? No, he didn't. He himself attributed it to Plato. Therefore, establishing in the Christian church, the apostate Christian church, Plato as one of the church fathers, which we found very interesting. There's the other heretical sects, perhaps the most important one being Gnosticism. Gnosticism had a certain agenda. It had to account for the existence of evil without compromising the character of the supreme being. God could not create evil, but the Old Testament God created the world, therefore God could not be the same supreme being. They had to find someone else. This led to the doctrine of dualism. Another doctrine that the body of Jesus was only an appearance. It brought about anti-Semitism. Rejection of all the Old Testament and New Testament, except for Paul and parts of the Gospel. Striving after a systematic theology. It was aristocratic in the sense that it was elevated by knowledge, not of facts, but of mysteries. Now this is important too. If your knowledge is based on facts, you can find those facts objectively. If they are based on mysteries, then you have to go through a channel that is going to give you that revealed mystery, thus giving rise to the dependence upon a clergy. One of the most important Gnostics was Tatian. And he wrote an oration to the Greeks. And we'd just like to say about him that his classical references and quotations are more numerous than those of the early Christian, any other early Christian writer, except Clement of Alexandria. What his contribution then was not just argument based on reason or argument based on these mysteries, but also argument based on sophistication in the Greek and Latin and other literatures. There was one named Basilides. He was a man deeply versed in Greek and Jewish Alexandrian philosophy. He had a great contribution. His philosophy was fundamentally pantheistic. His favorite designation of God was the non-existent one. And so his theology was, the non-existent God made a non-existent world from things non-existent, having cast down and deposited a single seed, having in itself the universal seed of the world. Isn't it great that he set us straight on that? We then move down to another one of the Gnostics, Marcion. He was the first one to encourage us to form a New Testament canon. So, taking all the holy writings and reducing that then down to a list of what would be approved writings. Now, another group of people were what we would call the Apostolic Fathers, or what we would term, or what history terms, the sub-apostolic generation. Now, it is in this list of the fathers that some of that list of names that the pastor gave would reside. There's Clement, Clement of Rome, also termed the fourth pope. Now, Clement wrote a letter to Corinth as the bishop of Rome, and in this letter, he was intervening in church quarrels that were outside of Rome. Now, what does that mean? He was encouraging them to harmony and order, and he was suggesting his authority over the other bishops. But at this point, his authority was challenged. To him, the terms elder and bishop were still interchangeable, and this is significant as we go down the road. He also suggested apostolic succession, although not at this point not making it a doctrine, but suggesting that the bishops as a body were the successors of the apostles as a body.
His tone was big brotherly,
and he expected to be listened to. Another was Ignatius. They called him the bearer of God. And Ignatius was a very influential one. He was referred to by some as the second successor of Paul. He had been the bishop of Antioch, ordained in 69 A.D. His teaching about Jesus was, he was truly born, he truly suffered, he was truly crucified. He was flesh, yet spiritual, born, yet unbegotten, genuine life in the midst of death. So we see here the beginnings of that confusion of truly God and truly man for Jesus Christ. So the beginning of the questions that were going to lead to the doctrine of the Trinity. He's the first one who used the term Catholic, and he made no apology for the office of the bishops. He said it's a high office. His doctrine was, let no man perform anything without the bishop, in his epistle to the Smyrnaeans. He assumes the existence of the institution, that is, of bishops, and then he elaborates upon them, which was a favorite ploy of the popes, as we read in the second volume down the road. Wherever Jesus is, there is the Catholic Church, and the authority resides with the Church. The bishops reflect the mind of Jesus Christ. And then he makes a distinction between a bishop and an elder. He is then the inventor of the ministerial structure, that is, the apostate ministerial structure, of bishop, elder, and deacon, the hierarchy beginning with the bishop, the centralization in Rome, with Peter and Paul being the founders of this, the claimed founders of this centralization. Then there is Polycarp. He was a bishop of Smyrna. Tradition says that he was converted by the Apostle John in the year 104. He became bishop of Smyrna in 107 to 116. He visited Rome in around 154 to 155. And he defended celebrating Easter on Passover. And this was not in agreement with the Pope. He was opposed on this by Victor, who was the bishop of Rome at the time, and he was threatened with excommunication. He was martyred in 155 at age 86. He was burned alive. Interestingly enough, he was given several opportunities to worship Caesar. He hid for a few days, trying to escape his persecution, and then calmly gave himself up. And then, another one of the names, Apollonius. He was a Roman senator, but he was accused by a servant Severus of being a Christian. He gave an admirable discourse about his faith, and then he was sentenced to beheading. And so he was martyred under the Emperor Commodus. Another group were the apologists. The apologists in the middle of the second century had a little bit different mission from the Gnostics. Their mission was to secure a right for Christianity to exist, to answer the charges of atheism, licentiousness, and of all things cannibalism, to demonstrate the antiquity of their faith through the Old Testament, to argue for the purity of Jesus Christ and the purity of the Christian life, and to avoid persecution by proving rumors wrong. So it's interesting here, friends, that the apologists wanted to change the face that the world had put on Christianity. And in so doing, they were forced into a compromising position rather than cheerfully accepting the persecution that was put on them. One of the most noted was Aristides. He wrote an apology to Antoninus Pius, the emperor. He's the earliest one of the apologists whose writings are extant. And by the way, friends, when we say apologist, when we think of apology, we think of saying, well, I'm sorry I did this. An apology as a rhetorical device is the defense of a particular position using certain oratorical and literary techniques. He displayed a remarkable acquaintance not only with Greek and Roman philosophy and religion, but also with Egyptian, Persian, and possibly Indian systems. He set forth the character of the heathen deities in a repulsive light, and his apology comes near being what is termed a polemic. That is a piece of literature that goes on the attack. But the writing is conciliatory in spirit, might have been expected to make a favorable impression with an emperor who had little regard for the current polytheism. Remember, this was Antoninus Pius, who said, let the gods defend themselves if they're offended by this. History says that no nobler defense of Christianity was ever written, but it's possible that it had something to do with the comparatively favorable attitude of Antoninus toward Christians. But it also bordered on flattery of the emperor. And this is where we say that instead of cheerfully accepting the persecution, they were forced into a position of compromise by trying to convince the governmental leaders. Justin Martyr is an important name in this list as well. He came from paganism down a corridor of philosophy, Stoicism, Aristotelianism, Pythagoreanism, and Platonism. He tells us that was in his autobiography. He became a confessor and undertook to defend his new faith to philosophers and political leaders. In 153, he came to Rome, and shortly thereafter, he wrote his apology. And just a little bit on Justin Martyr. He was converted to Christianity in 130. He moved to Rome. He interpreted the Old Testament as prophesying Jesus. In his first apology, he rejected the Roman gods. He accepted the charge of atheism, meaning if you define atheism as believing in one God rather than multiple gods, then yes, I'm guilty of that. The whole world was opposed to Christians and Christ. He rejected remarriage after divorce. He opposed the Platonic immortality. He believed in the rationality of the gospel. And he distinguished the Heavenly Father, from Jesus Christ. But he considered Socrates to be a Christian. He was martyred under Marcus Aurelius. Other apologists were Titian, and we'll mention him down the road a little bit, and Athenagoras. Athenagoras, next to Justin Martyr, may be ranked as the next most influential. In the year 177 was when he wrote his apology to Marcus Aurelius and his son Commodus. It's written in rhetorical style, abounds in quotations from the Greek classics, and is exceedingly conciliatory in tone, verging upon flattery. He, on the other hand, advocated Plato's version of immortality. Next in rank of influence was Theophilus of Antioch. He became bishop of Antioch in the 8th year of Marcus Aurelius, around 168 AD. He wrote a treatise in the year 190 in defense of Christianity. And the main object was not to defend the Christians, although this is not neglected in his work, but rather to convince the emperor of the absurdity of heathenism and the truth of Christianity. Theophilus, like Athenagoras, shows great familiarity with the Greek classics, and his writings are frequently resorted to by critics of the classical Greek texts on account of their richness in citations. So, he wrote this defense of Christianity, but he went into so much flowery description of the ancient Greek classics that he became more of a source for the Greek classical scholars. And his position on immortality, and these various positions on immortality, friends, we would recommend to you reprint 3382, where the pastor discusses immortality in the early church, and the pastor is actually quoting liberally from an author, J. Edgar Beat, a D.D. and professor in a Methodist college in England. So he's quoting from this other source, but he quotes him in reprint 3382. So Theophilus says, but some will say to us, was man by nature mortal? Certainly not. Was he immortal? Neither do we affirm this. But one will say, was he then nothing? Not even this hits the mark. He was by nature neither mortal nor immortal. For if he had made him immortal from the beginning, he would have made him God. Again, if he had made him mortal, God would seem to be the cause of his death. Neither the immortal nor yet mortal did he make him,
but as we have said above, capable of both. So that if he should incline to things of immortality, keeping the commandment of God, he should receive as a reward from him immortality. He goes on like this, friend, but you see what his point of confusion still was. His point of confusion was, if man is mortal, then he has death built into him, whereas if he is immortal, death is an impossibility. How thankful we should be, friends, how the pastor from all of this, ignoring all this writing, going directly to what is in the scripture, identifies as mortality as being subject to death, but not necessarily having to die, and immortality as being what comes as a result of the reward. There were certain attempts at reform, one of them being the Montanists, and again, there's not really a need to go into a great detail on the Montanists. There are some others, Donatists. What we do want to bring out, though, is under these reforms, these attempts at reforms, around the year 150 was the beginning of the Apostles' Creed. Now, we usually date the Apostles' Creed a little bit later, don't we? But this is the beginning of writing the text of the Apostles' Creed. And it was intended to be a symbol of faith. And what do we mean by a symbol of faith? A means of recognition, a means whereby Christians could distinguish true believers from those who followed the various heresies circulating at the time, particularly Gnosticism and Marcionism. Any who could affirm this creed were neither Gnostics or Marcionites. Interesting, isn't it, friends, that in our time, in 1846, with the cleansing of the sanctuary, came about a list of beliefs that would distinguish Orthodox Christianity from the other sects. And where do we find ourselves? Hopefully, we find ourselves outside of this system of orthodoxy. We find ourselves in the cleansed sanctuary. We look at other defenders of the faith, so to speak. Clement of Alexandria, not to be confused with Clement of Rome. Clement of Alexandria, now at the other end, of the far end of the second century. He pursued studies under various masters, various nationalities, and religious and philosophical views. He at last came to rest under the influence of the head of the school in Alexandria. And again, we don't want to go into a great deal of detail on him, but he wrote a work called An Address to the Greeks, possibly the earliest of his writings. Its aim is to prove that those conversant with Greek philosophy, the infinite superiority of Christianity. So, again, trying to demonstrate the superiority of Christianity in terms of Greek and classical literature. Another big name at this time, again toward the late end of the second century, Origen. In 202, he took over for Clement in the school of Alexandria. He became the most influential thinker of his age. The school at Alexandria reached its highest point under him, attracting large numbers of pagans and Gnostics as well as Christians. Clement and Origen may be regarded as the first really scientific students of Christianity and the Christian scriptures. So here we see another move of sophistication in the Christian church of trying to take what might be termed a scientific or sophisticated approach to systematic Christianity. Now we could take a look also, friends, at the line of popes during this period. Who was the first pope? That's right. That's right. Now, certainly none of us would say that, but tradition assigns Peter as the first pope, followed by Linus and Cletus. And we go down to Clement. Remember we mentioned Clement of Rome? And we talked about his influence in terms of trying to bolster the importance of the bishop at Rome. In the second century, we might bring out Sixtus I from 116 to 125. During his time, the common language of the religious liturgy was probably Greek. We move down to Pius I, 158 to 167. He is the first to speak of the succession of the apostles. Now remember, we said that Clement introduced the thought, suggested it, implied it. Pius I is now systematizing the succession of the apostles from the body of apostles to the body of bishops. We go down to Victor the First, one of the very influential of the bishops of Rome, or popes, 189 to 198, taking us toward the end of this century. Victor contrived synods in Rome, Palestine, and elsewhere that decided in favor of Roman practice regarding Easter. You recall that the churches of Asia Minor, led by Polycrates, bishop of Ephesus, refused to conform to this Roman edict. Victor excommunicated them. The action was not effective in Asia Minor, but enabled Victor to enact uniform practice in his own church. So, Victor excommunicated the Eastern bishops who resisted his edict on the celebration of Easter. They said, "You can't excommunicate us. Who are you?" But by his doing that, and even with the opposition that they gave to him, it gave him a voice of authority closer to home, so that his locals saw him as a superior bishop, even though the rest of the bishops didn't yet recognize that. But this was a sign that the Roman Church and its bishop were acquiring authority and influence beyond their own immediate sphere, an authority and influence which no other church could equal. Until late in the second century, the Bishop of Rome was the only bishop in Italy, and Rome was the only apostolic church in the West, placing him on a par with bishops of the great Eastern sees, such as Antioch and Alexandria. These facts paved the way for the events of the 4th and 5th centuries. Now see, friends, this also is very important. If you have bishops all over the place, but in a certain geographical area around Rome, there was only one, it wasn't a group of Western bishops in competition with a group of Eastern bishops. It was the Western bishop and the see of Eastern bishops. And it enabled him then to have a more singular visibility. So by the 3rd century, the Bishop of Rome was gaining a very prominent place. And we could mention a couple of the popes of the 3rd century. But we'll just single out Calixtus I. He was the first to invoke Petrine authority. That is the authority of Peter. So we see the stages. The stages of suggesting apostolic succession, systematizing apostolic succession, and then saying the Bishop of Rome is the successor of Peter. And that was the contribution of Calixtus I. He excommunicated Sibelius, who he believed in the unity of God, but stated that it was not the Father who died, but the Son. With this judgment, unclear and ambiguous as it was, the matter rested for the moment. So he made this statement of saying, well, it's the same God, or there's only one, but it was the Son who died and not the Father. So it was an unresolved question. And this was the unresolved question that the 3rd century dealt with, and that was eventually dealt with in the 4th century church at the Council of Nicaea. We might look at some of the other bishops of the time. Probably we'd want to single out the Bishop of Sardis, who was Melito. Again, one of the names listed in the pastor's paragraph there. He had considerable eminence in the 2nd century. He was, as we mentioned, the Bishop of Sardis. He urged Marcus Aurelius to stop persecuting the Christians. He wrote an apology for Christianity that claims that it sprang from paganism. Now, this is very important. Why would a Christian, especially a Christian who had the ear of the emperor, why would he claim that Christianity rose from paganism? Because it was easier to sell. Rather than saying we are at odds with paganism, we are at odds with atheism, we're saying, Rome, Mr. Emperor, this is your religion. The antiquity that you have worshipped, the gods that you have worshipped, Christianity is just a natural extension of that. That's why you should accept it. We might mention also of Melito. that he declared in his writings that the time of Augustus was providential. Now you recall, the time of Augustus was considered the golden age of Rome, from about 29 B.C. to about, 14 A.D., time of Augustus, the golden age of Rome, saying this is a particularly providential time. Again, saying this so as to make the Roman emperor feel good about it. We might mention a bit about Irenaeus and his significance. He wrote a book that was called Five Books Against Heresies, in which the views of the different heretical sects are stated and refuted, and in which Christian doctrine is ably expounded. So his contribution, in a word, is a greater systemization of Christian doctrine and teaching. You know, friends, as we were preparing our remarks, we made an outline. Before we did any of the research, we made an outline of some of the things that we wanted to cover. And item 14 in our list was traces of the truly faithful. And friends, we'll just ask you, how much do you think history says about the truly faithful in the second century? You're absolutely right. Nothing. Because they were overrun by Greek philosophy, overrun by classical sophistication, and these other things. Friends, there are a couple of things that we would have liked to cover, but we'll just review what characterized the second century. It was the church of the metropolis, the natural focus of the faithful. Contacts with government were easy. The diffusion of Christianity so far had been steady, more steady than rapid, but it had struck roots in Italy, Africa, and Gaul. Christianity was becoming a book religion. And you know, one of the conveniences of the bishop in Rome, the church at Rome, it was able to intercede in the government, with the governor. It was able to help the other churches. And guess what it did to help the other churches? It accumulated wealth. What a wonderful thing for the benefit of the other churches that it would accumulate wealth to help them interceding with the government. And that was the beginning, again, one of the beginnings of this rise of Rome. We might trace the development of the doctrine of the Trinity amongst the fathers. Christ's preexistence and its role in creation was assumed. But the fathers did not really propound the doctrine of the Trinity. The apologists went into this sophisticated intellectual argument trying to link God with the pagan God, and therefore trying to bring in the Trinity that way. And I'm sorry that we can't go into much more detail on that. In summary, about the immortality of the soul. Immortality of the soul was not a well-established doctrine in the second century. There were differing views on this, but the seeds were laid for later argumentation of it, based on Plato. So, the significance of the second century to us, friends, why did we go through this ordeal of looking at the second century? It does have a significance to us. The earliest period we might call the edificatory period. Well, forget the word edificatory, but it was unsophisticated in classical literature, and it was simple statements of faith. That's what the apostles delivered to the Christians when they fell asleep. But it was what they did with it. They turned it into this apologetic period of trying to defend Christianity to those where they had no business defending it, an appeal to the educated class, to the emperors, an appeal in terms of classical literature and philosophy. And what we term the polemical period, that is, of going on the attack, a voice of condemnation against various other viewpoints, the shift from Oriental to Western, be pushing this Eastern mystery to the more methodical West, so that Rome could pick up the ball in its time. The scientific study of Christianity, speculative, systematic. And what was delivered to the third century from the second century was a different Trinity, the Trinity of the canon of Scripture, the canon of doctrine, and the authority of the episcopate, that is, the authority of the bishops. Well, friends, let's look for a moment at our second century. When we determine what is an element of truth, and we try the spirits to determine what is truth, do we argue in terms of our conventional wisdom? Do we go to the fathers or the experts or the scientists or the great scholars? Or do we look to the simple declarations of Scripture and accept what the apostles delivered to us and what the Lord delivered to us? We talk about the gifts of the church, the gifts of the church being all men, one of the gifts of the church being the messengers and the seventh messenger. Do we accept with simple mind what is delivered to us at the hands of our harvest messenger? We'd just like to mention also, friends, that, you know, we've investigated a number of subjects where the pastor would make some fleeting remark and he would give us some references. And so we then go and we look at these references in detail. And what do we come back with time after time? Is that the pastor, in a few paragraphs or in a few short sentences, absolutely hits the nail on the head. And after we do that a few times, we, sooner or later, would come to the realization that, you know, the pastor gets it right. He gets it right time after time after time. So that when we go into this other reading, we don't go into this other reading with a spirit of doubt, meaning with a spirit of unseating or being dissatisfied with what the pastor has prepared for us. If we have time to do that, we go with it in a spirit of filling in the detail, filling in the context. So with that, friends, may the Lord guide us.
Thank you, Brother Barry. The second century certainly makes us thankful that we can take that scripture, blessed is he who comes to 1335 days, 1874. I'm sure we all lived back then. I thank you. It was a tremendous study. It was a very hard one.